And we have final matter before oral argument, A221685, 1685. Rachel Marie Benedict is petitioner respondent, Thomas Jerry Benedict appellant. And so as counsel approach, I'll summarize a few points, but you can have a seat as soon as you're comfortable. We ask each counsel when you do approach the podium to announce who you are and who you represent. There is a button on there if you want the podium adjusted to your comfort. And also we do have the light there, or the timer indicating, so you'll have your time in front of you. Oh, and we are recording these proceedings. The recording will be available on the court's website within 24 hours, should you wish to go back and hear how you sounded. Counsel for appellant, you may approach and identify yourself and then begin.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm Matt Gilbert, representing the appellant, Thomas Benedict. Trial courts are charged under Minnesota Statute 518.58 with dividing the marital estate, which consists of assets and debts. Trial courts cannot divide past expenses by one party unless all elements of a dissipation claim are met. The dissipation statute under 518.58 subdivision 1A is very detailed.
Can you cite me to the case that you have for legal support that you can't even consider dissipation under subdivision 1 when assessing the, I'm trying to remember what the right term is, the protection of the marital estate? Because it seems to me like the clear disagreement between the parties on this issue is whether dissipation broadly can be considered under subdivision 1 or whether it has to be considered under subdivision 1A.
Your Honor, the statute is clear. This is if there's a expense or disposition of assets that's challenged, this is the basis to recover those funds.
Well, 1A has to do with what happened during or what's happening during the dissolution proceedings. I think that there's a fair reading of the statute that 1A has to do with conduct that happens during the dissolution proceedings, and 1 is about what happened during the marriage.
1 refers to dividing assets and debts, how the marital estate will be divided. And what happens in marital dissolution proceedings is sometimes in anticipation of a divorce, parties start dissipating or transferring or concealing assets into different accounts. And that's why this statute was created, to take into consideration past expenses that either party has made, so long as these four statutory criteria are satisfied.
But subdivision 1 specifically says that the court needs to consider the contribution of each to the acquisition, preservation, depreciation, or appreciation in the amount or value of the marital property under subdivision 1 as part of dividing those assets. And then subdivision 2 says during the pendency of the dissolution, separation, or annulment, and then goes on to explain what happens. And so I think that part of this dispute is whether 1A is triggered when what you're talking about is stuff that happens during the marriage versus whether 1A is only triggered when you're talking about what's happening during the actual dissolution action.
In the plain language of the statute, I think is key because it refers to the appreciation acquisition of assets.
Or
depreciation of assets.
Can consider the contribution of each to the depreciation in the amount or value of the marital property.
And there's also a presumption in that statute that both parties are contributing to the marital estate, and that's a presumption that the trial court never applied. But two, there's statutory...
Yeah, but I'm just trying to tease out this. Do we need to apply subdivision 1 or do we need to apply subdivision 1A? And I'm asking, do you have any cases that have said when you're considering a dissipation claim that you need to analyze that under 1A as opposed to analyzing it under this provision in subdivision 1?
The statute itself refers specifically to assets under subdivision 1, and 1A refers to the disposition of assets, so assets that are no longer there, that are no longer a part of the marital estate. So that's the plain distinction in the statute itself. As far as a case, again, if there's a challenged expenditure, this is the statutory criteria. This is the dissipation statute. We've cited numerous cases that cite to this being the dissipation statute, and this is the statutory framework.
But aren't all of those cases things that happen during marriage, dissolution, separation, or annulment? I'm asking because I haven't been able to find a case that applies Subdivision 1A to a context like this, where what we're talking about is things that happen during the marriage, not things that happen during the dissolution.
And, Your Honor, the statute provides, 1A provides in contemplation of a divorce proceeding. And part of the legislative intent of this statute was to prevent expenses from 20 years ago suddenly being questioned by a spouse, unless there was the statutory criteria that were satisfied.
Can I ask a question? Is the problem with what the district court did here, does it basically boil down to its use of the word dissipated? Because I'm looking at this paragraph where that discussion happens on page 25 of the findings of fact, conclusion, amended findings of fact, conclusion of law and order, and the court cites Subdivision 1 and the language that Judge Larson was referring to in talking about the acquisition, preservation, depreciation, or appreciation of the amount or value of the marital property, acknowledges your client's contribution to the marital estate with regard to the payoff of the mortgage, and then goes on to discuss what could, apart from using the word dissipated, be categorized as things that that your client did with regard to the preservation, depreciation of the marital estate. And that would be something that the court needs to consider under the statute in order to make a fair and equitable division of the assets. And that's how the court ultimately couched its decision, is it would be unfair and inequitable to divide the assets other than what the court decided to do. So why isn't that a proper exercise under Subdivision 1?
And Your Honor, that's of the existing assets at the time of the valuation date, if you look at Subdivision 1. Again, this is an expenditure. This is a refinance that was taken out in 2003, so 17 years before the dissolution proceeding was filed. Those factors should be considered in dividing what the assets are at the time of the valuation date. Again, with that reading of the statute, that would render Subdivision 1A entirely meaningless.
Well, it would mean the Subdivision 1A is about what you do during a marriage, dissolution, separation, or annulment proceeding, as opposed to what happens during the marriage.
Well, 1A refers to...
during the pendency of the marriage, dissolution, separation, or annulment proceeding, comma, or in contemplation of commencing a marriage, dissolution, separation, or annulment proceeding, is how that statute begins, which would indicate to me, that the legislature's intent is that that's what you evaluate when you're looking at dissipation of assets. That's the circumstance where I'm thinking I'm going to get a divorce, and so I'm going to take a bunch of marital assets and hide them in some hidden account that my spouse doesn't know about because I'm planning on filing for divorce, as opposed to a case like this where it's things that happen during the course of the marriage when no one has said that a divorce was contemplated in 2012.
And part of this, Your Honor, comes back to notice and the opportunity to be heard. I mean, the court, if you adopt that interpretation of the statute, you're essentially calling for a disproportionate division of the marital estate. And the statute is clear that these statutory factors need to be considered.
Well, the district court applied Subdivision 1. You've argued to our court that we should apply Subdivision 1A. I think that the issue is teed up for us whether or not it was appropriate for the district court to apply Subdivision 1 as opposed to Subdivision 1A.
And if you do apply Subdivision 1, there is the statutory presumption that was not applied by the trial court, that both parties contributed to the acquisition of assets as a part of the marital estate.
Well, I didn't quite read the order quite that way, but I was going to follow up with Judge Larson's question. In 2013, we have the Zarkey decision, and that was it was non-precedential regarding the district court referred to appellate's actions as to the lottery scam as dissipation of marital assets. And so it was a similar argument made by the appellant in that case. And what we said there is, nor do we agree that because subdivision 1A did not apply, they were essentially saying it was that same colloquial phrase that we see thrown in both all kinds of division 1A, subdivision 1. We went on to say the district court is, nor do we agree that because 1A did not apply, the district court is precluded from achieving the same result under subdivision 1, and then cites Fick versus Fick from 1985, holding that even where the evidence does not establish that a party purposely concealed, dissipated, or misused assets in anticipation of the divorce, a party may be credited or charged with the property for division purposes if the party nevertheless exercised dominion over the property, had discretion over the use of the money. When I'm reading, this district court is applying that, maybe not citing to it as I recall, that kind of, that premise in determining that the lying about the purpose for the need to refinance was a way of contributing to the depreciation of the value, and then in equitable distribution was able to offset that. What's wrong with doing that under subdivision 1?
Your Honor, frankly, I think the trial court got pretty cute with the statute. I mean, the statute is pretty clear as far as if there's expenses that are incurred that are being challenged, that falls under the dissipation part of 1A. Even with that, the dissipation statute describes the relief, the statutory relief, if there is a dissipation. And we cited CYREC for the proposition that the statutory remedy is to put the asset back in, to restore the parties to the same position if the asset had not been dissipated. And here, the court even failed to do that or apply what's provided for in the statute. Again, and there was the clear.
But
I'm sorry.
Isn't it true even our subdivision 1, it's very discretionary and equitable, and it doesn't have to be mathematically equal, and as long as the court makes findings about how the parties contribute to, and in this case, it would be the depreciation, that would be proper under subdivision 1, correct?
The court has the authority to make a disproportionate division of the marital estate, but with that, there need to be detailed factual findings consistent with 518.58, and there also needs to be the application of the statutory presumption.
But isn't that what the court did, though, with the findings? It was very specific about both the Cooperstown trip and the refinance, the reasons the judge made an inequitable or other than 50-50 because of the specific facts that the court found credible.
And I'm sorry, the detailed findings set forth in the statute, there's statutory criteria that the trial court is charged with analyzing those factors, especially when there's a disproportionate division made. And again, there's also
And I do think that the factors that are set forth in the statute have more to do with respondent than, I mean, when I was looking at the factors yesterday, they have more to do with respondent's current, how the division leaves respondent as opposed to bad conduct on the part of your client when you're actually looking at the 518.58 sub 2 sub factors, right? I don't think that you're allowed under. I think that your argument is that you don't get to look at your client's conduct. It has more to do when evaluating undue hardship of looking at the hardship to respondent as opposed to whatever conduct your client did or did not do during the marriage.
And I think that's part of the issue because in addition to the statutory factors, I mean, the court made a finding that it's unknown where the proceeds of the refinance went. And there was testimony at trial that there was substantial home improvements made to the home during the marriage. There's no real findings regarding what incomes and other contributions made to the parties made to the marital estate, nor the application of that, again, the statutory presumption.
But that's not what undue hardship is about. Undue hardship, I mean, when you're invading the non-marital property, undue hardship has to do with once we have divided the non-marital and the marital property, we look at the position that before we can take assets from your client, non-marital assets, and give them to the spouse, you have to look at the undue hardship to the respondent, which isn't the conduct of your client. It's what's the financial position that respondent was left in. And I think that the district court didn't really evaluate that as so much as it evaluated the conduct of your client.
Correct. And with the unfair hardship, the invasion of non-marital assets, that requires an analysis of statutory factors, which was never made, as well as my client was never given notice that that was an argument that was being made or that the court would be deciding upon. Same with a fraudulent inducement argument. Notice and the opportunity to be heard is a tenet of due process, and my client didn't have due process in regard to those claims. When you look at it, I mean, this is clearly a challenge of two expenses, one made in 2003, so about 17 years before the divorce was filed, as well as a trip for the party's joint son to go on a baseball trip. Again, we've cited a lot of case law. If there's a challenge expense, it has to fit within that statutory framework of subdivision 1A. And it really would render that entire statute meaningless if this court found otherwise. Thank you.
Very well. And you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Counsel for responding. You may approach, identify yourself, and then begin.
May it please the court and opposing counsel. My name is Mallory Stoll. I represent the respondent, Rachel Marie Benedict. Ms. Benedict is also present in the courtroom this, I think it's still morning, Your Honors.
You've got 6 minutes.
Thank you. Your Honors, the issues before the court really do come down to two expenditures, a 2003 refinance that was totaled $75,000 and an $11,300 expenditure for a Cooperstown trip. These were not expenses, nor were these analyzed as expenses. Rather, the district court analyzed them as encumbrances upon the marital estate that consequently reduced the net value of the marital estate. The district court, in its detailed findings, after a two-day trial and numerous exhibits being offered, took great pains to analyze all relevant factors, as the district court is required to do under 518.58 subdivision 1.
Can I ask you a question about that?
Yes.
My concern is that the court cites 518.58 subdivision 2 in explaining the need to invade the non-marital property. But that statute and our cases specifically note that if the court apportions property other than marital property, it shall make findings in support of the apportionment. The findings shall be based on all relevant factors, including, and this is what Judge Larson was touching on in your counterpart's argument, you probably expected the question. I don't see that the district court made those findings in the district court's order. So my concern is, why isn't it an abuse of discretion for the district court not to have followed the statute in making those findings? Because we can't really review the decision appropriately on appeal without those specific findings required by statute.
Judge Eade, I hope I'll have the opportunity to respond to that question, the entirety of that question, because I think we have to look at several parts with that. First, in making the division of property that the district court did, there were several reasons cited for it. One of those was the citation to 518.58 subdivision 2 to prevent unfair hardship. But respondent would submit we don't even need to get that far because of all of the other factors, the relevant factors in this case, that the district court considered when apportioning marital property.
Before you finish answering,
yes.
Is that why the judge, this was in the amended order, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
There was a preface, if I recall, something to the extent necessary.
Is that
what you're getting at? Was it kind of an alternative? I didn't quite know why the judge used that phrase, but is that your reading of that?
Precisely.
Because of what you just said a moment ago.
Precisely.
Okay. Sorry to interrupt.
No, thank you, Judge Slater. So that would be the first part of my response. Second, Your Honor.
But you don't disagree that the district court took non-marital assets from appellant and attribute, I mean, I understand that the non-marital asset is an interest in the home where I believe your client lives. So essentially reduced the amount that your client owes to appellant from non-marital assets. I mean, that's what happened, right?
I believe I agree. I'm going to tell you
how I
read it. So if we look specifically at page 26 of the amended judgment and decree, the lien that was assigned to the homestead that was awarded to Ms. Benedict comes from the non-marital interest. And so what the district court ultimately did was reduce the value of the non-marital interest in determining the amount of the lien.
Which would be part of the non-marital property.
I do not agree with that, Your Honor, okay. And that's because, so with the non-marital claim that Mr. Benedict made at trial, he didn't do a Schmitz formula. He didn't really do any tracing. It really came down to the testimony of the parties. What the district court ultimately did, though, seeing as though there was such a significant non-marital interest in the home with the payoff of the mortgage, is reduce that based on the fact that it would, well, I think it's two different schools of thought. Number one, to accomplish an equitable division of the marital property, but then we have on the other camp, reducing the non-marital interest, as the court can do if there is not adequate tracing and additional conduct that calls into question whether the non-marital property retained its character.
But the district court explicitly found that this non-marital property did maintain that character. I mean, that's part of the findings.
The district court determined that based on the testimony of the parties, it would limit the value of the starting value of the non-marital interest to the payoff amount, which was the $244,000.
And that was fairly traceable to the inheritance.
Correct.
The non-marital inheritance.
Correct. But that doesn't mean that the non-marital interest can't reduce over the period of time and ultimately in a dissolution.
But once it characterizes it as a non-marital property, isn't that what triggers 518-58 subdivision 2 if the district court's going to reduce that? Wouldn't you agree? I mean, once we're talking about a reduction of non-marital property, even if it is aimed at a fair and equitable distribution of the marital estate, the court has to make those findings. The legislature is very clear.
I'm not disagreeing that that's what the statute says. I'm going to come back, though, to the fact that this case ultimately rests on 518.58 subdivision 1. This court can readily affirm the entire decision from the amended judgment and decree based solely on 518.58 subdivision 1. As the colloquy went with opposing counsel, his entire principal argument centers on 1A, which does not apply to this.
Can I follow up? Because I'm kind of having a hard time following this too completely.
Yes.
Is that, and perhaps it's a characterization of the order and how we understand it, is that what you're saying? Because the house, the dissipation of an asset that is presumptively marital, but then we have this tracing issue, so in a good chunk of it obviously became non-marital. Is that because that's the process the court used to get down to what is non-marital after the deduction, even though it looks on its face like, well, $244,000 starts with that, and she has some findings that seem to suggest that. Is that what you're saying, that that's why subdivision 2 is not invoked, because it served to value what the non-marital interest was before, and what was left is actually non-marital versus what looks like on the chart to be starting with the top number? Is that, because that seems like the only way you could avoid subdivision 2 issue is still valuing what's marital and what's non-marital and doing it through this subtraction.
I don't agree, because I'm going to come back to, I think these are two distinct issues. However, I think if this court finds that the way that the parties' respective property was divided, that resulted in Ms. Benedict receiving a greater share of the assets, this subdivision to, it's not dicta, but it is really fleeting. we don't even get there.
But subdivision one is limited to marital property, right? So you, I mean, subdivision one can't be the basis for a statement in the district court's order that the district court is reducing non-marital property without us having to look at subdivision two of 518.58, right? I mean,
it can be a basis, though, for the court to allocate those debts to Mr. Benedict. That's part of marital property division, and that's what the district court did.
I mean, the court, I don't think the court can't do what the court did. It just has to make the findings required by the statute to get there, right?
Absolutely, and I think the district court did, because I feel that the briefing really confused what we're here talking about today because of the focus, not only on 1A, but the fact that we're focusing so much on the non-marital interest when it was one sentence of the court's entire order. And 1A just doesn't apply. And so we're here looking at one. We have a whole body of case law.
I mean, he's also argued subdivision two and that the district court, I mean, it sounds to me like, you know, your preferred reading of the order would be that the money that was paid for to pay off the mortgage was essentially a marital payment, but that's not the decision that the district court made. The district court made the decision that that was a non-marital, that that's non-marital, that it's fairly traceable, and then the district court went on to reduce the amount of that non-marital estate because of other things that happened during the course of the marriage. And I just don't know, going back to Judge Eade's point, subdivision one has to do with division of marital assets. And if you're dividing non-marital, like as soon as you're crossing the line into making decisions about non-marital assets, it seems to me that subdivision two requires some pretty specific findings and that those findings aren't really about bad conduct during the marriage, but they're about the length of the marriage, the age of the parties, health, station, occupation, sources of income. It's those kind of factors that you are evaluating in terms of undue hardship, as opposed to the things that the district court was really relying on in this case, which more have to do with what was appellant's conduct during the course of the marriage.
If this court believes that there are inadequate findings and it believes that the district court's decision cannot be affirmed based solely on applying 518.58 subdivision 1, then I think ultimately what would need to happen is a remand for additional findings.
But before we get there, there are some findings in the findings of fact, conclusion of law, and order that go to your client's age. So can you point us to parts of the order that might avoid that result that would be either explicitly making the findings that are required under subdivision two or implicitly arguably making those findings? Is that you think it's borne out by the order in other places, maybe not where the ruling is made, but somehow otherwise encapsulated by the order?
Well, I think the discussion we've had thus far during my portion of the argument centers around there may not be sufficient findings, and I certainly understand that's what appellant's argument is as well. Yes, there are findings regarding the parties' ages, their employment, their gross incomes, the property that's awarded to them. Yes, those are throughout the amended judgment and decree. I don't want to waste the court's time with flipping through the 50-plus page order to find each of those, but suffice it to say that this court will find them within the findings of fact. I do just have 2.5 minutes remaining. I do want to turn back to really what this case comes down to. And
can we talk about the Cooperstown trip? I have a few.
Sure.
I have a few questions, Judge Sleater. So
excellent idea.
It may go past the
training
2 minutes.
Training is opening up soon, too. Yeah.
And my question has to go to whether your client is getting double recovery for the Cooperstown trip. And this is why. So the district court decides first that husband had $41,000-ish of inheritance money that got commingled with marital assets. And then the district court relies on husband's testimony at the deposition that he intended to use, and I think the district court says non-marital assets, to pay for the Cooperstown trip. But I think if you go back and you look at the deposition, what he actually testified was that he intended to use his inheritance to pay for the Cooperstown trip. And so if the district court has found that the inheritance, what was remaining of the inheritance, has been commingled and is now a marital asset, and then subsequently found that husband wanted to use a non-marital asset when he said that he intended to use his inheritance, which would be the $41,000 that is now determined to be a marital asset, are those findings inconsistent, is my question.
I don't think so, and I mean, so the Cooperstown and the 2003 refinance were both really, had very similar themes of deceit, dishonesty, and encumbrance of the marital estate.
But I would like to set aside the 2003 refinance. I just want to focus on Cooperstown, okay. Because in a normal marriage, right, my husband makes a decision to send our daughter to camp, doesn't talk to me about it. She goes to camp. 10 years later, we get divorced. In the normal case, I'm not going to be able to get the money back for sending our daughter to camp, even though he made that decision without my knowledge, didn't get my approval for making that payment. He's making that payment out of using our joint marital assets. So in a normal case, spending money on a joint child without approval of the other parent isn't generally going to result in that being a non-marital debt. And it seems to me that what, according to the district court, converted this from a marital to a non-marital debt was his testimony at the deposition that he intended to use his inheritance to pay for the trip.
Judge Leader, I do see I'm out of time. May I respond to Judge Larson's
certainly.
Question? Okay. Number one, I don't think this is a normal case. You said normal case. Number two, this Cooperstown expenditure was for an entire baseball team. This was not just for the party's child. This was an $11,300 expenditure. And certainly I can appreciate that, you know, we're coming up on spring training in Cooperstown. Like, I get it, but reviewing the transcripts and what my client testified to, I mean, this was significant, and I think we come back to, with this, and I will get to the non-marital piece for this, but I need to add this. The dissipation arguments that are replete throughout ignores the cases that were discussed with Nelson, with Zarcy, with Sirik, all addressed in the brief, that while this may not have been a claims that occurred in contemplation of divorce or during the pendency of the proceedings, which is when 1A applies, the district court can readily consider conduct that influences acquisition, preservation, appreciation, and depreciation of the marital estate. And that's where this case really starts and ends. Now, going back to the $11,300 Cooperstown, Judge Sleater, I think you had said, or no, it was Judge Ede, is the issue in the case, at least with this, the using the word dissipation. I would submit that looking at page 26 of the amended judgment and decree, the court did state non-marital debt, but I think ultimately perhaps the words were not the most artful, and how I read the amended judgment and decree is the district court said these expenditures encumbered the estate, and in order to accomplish an equitable division of marital property. I am going to assign the entirety of those two encumbrances to Mr. Benedict. So I think that, I'm sorry it took so long to get to the ultimate crux of your question, Judge Larson. I know that appellant in his brief makes that argument that is this double counting, double dipping, windfall, whatever term. I think that's perhaps the worst case scenario in this case, if anything, because Mr. Benedict wants credit for the entirety of these amounts, but that is the exact same issue that he's complaining that the district court did. So
I think that my problem is with everyone admits that he had $41,000 of inheritance money that got commingled into the estate. His testimony was he wanted to use his inheritance money to pay for the trip. But then the consequence is that that is a non-marital debt, even though by the point of the Cooperstown trip, all of his inheritance money had been commingled. And so it seems to me like there's $41,000 becoming part of the marital estate, and then he's being charged with the $11,000 that he wanted to pay out of his inheritance, and that seems like double counting.
But
I understand that this case is complicated and there were lots of different transactions and lots of stuff was going on, but just as to that particular issue and how it's been teed up for us, either the $11,300 was a marital, I think we would have to interpret the testimony that he wanted to use as inheritance as him continuing to think that his inheritance had not been commingled with the marital estate, right?
But I think that what that, and it, certainly there just may be a disagreement. When I read it, and I'm sorry, I can't find it in the amended judgment and decree. When I read the Cooperstown debt and the characterization on page 26 as a non-marital debt, I view it, how I read it, is that the district court's intent was that should be Mr. Benedict's sole responsibility. He has no funds to pay Ms. Benedict because his contribution to the marital estate was negative, and this is the only way to assure that it is properly counted for. I understand, and we've spent a lot of time talking about this issue. My answers may not be satisfactory, but I just don't know that I can provide any additional assistance on this question. Yeah. So I will simply just ask that this court affirm.
Well, and I appreciate the dialogue about the issue.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel. And counsel for appellant, you'll now have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. Your Honors are absolutely correct. Subdivision 1 describes division of marital property. Subdivision 2 describes invasion of non-marital property. With that said, the court made a detailed finding that Mr. Benedict had $244,822.62 as his non-marital interest in the property. And I'm sure the court is familiar with the schedule of the reductions that were made to his non-marital assets, specifically the Cooperstown payment and the 2003 refinance.
So do you disagree that we can read the amended findings of fact, conclusion of law, in order to find the missing findings that weren't necessarily explicitly made under subdivision 2?
Those findings were never made by the trial court in conjunction with subdivision 2. I think more importantly, Mr. Benedict was never given notice of an invasion of marital or non-marital asset claim, nor was he given the opportunity to respond to such claim. If the court reviews case law regarding invasion claims, it's very rare and in very extreme circumstances where an invasion would be awarded. There's no findings regarding the parties' assets, nor the disparity in their incomes. There's just no basis to have an invasion of non-marital assets. And again, I think the big issue here is the court sua sponte, without notice to Mr. Benedict, just threw this in, say, hey, in the alternative, this may apply. But again, that's contrary to giving my client due process, and it's contrary to the record before the court. The respondent was awarded the marital homestead as well as over $200,000 in a 401k. By no means was she suffering any type of unfair hardship, and under the plain language of the court's order, she was already awarded 55% of her retirement account. So she was already receiving a disproportionate division of the estate. We did cite CYRIC. CYRIC, it talks about subdivision 1A, but I think it's applicable here because it really refers to, even if these were marital assets, which they're not, but even if they were, it essentially provides that Mr. Benedict should half of these assets are his in these expenditures, even if they were marital. So if he pays for Cooperstown and let's say there was no inheritance, half of that expenditure would be his. And why should he have to double compensate Ms. Benedict for that expenditure? And that's specifically described in CYRIC, where it describes, when a disposed asset returns to the marital estate, it is duplicative to impute the asset's value to the offending party, because imputation is only a remedy to put the parties in the same position they would have been in had the disposition not occurred. The disposition provision of the statute was thus intended to provide a method of accounting that would facilitate a fair and equitable division of the property when an asset was no longer part of the marital estate. And again, you know, whether 1A applies or whether it's 1, it doesn't really matter, because we're talking about taking away Mr. Benedict's non-marital assets. For that reason, and since there was no notice to Mr. Benedict, again, the invasion claim just can't stand, especially as the court made that as an alternative argument sua sponte. So with that said, with the record before the court, we do ask the court reverse and award Mr. Benedict the entire value that was deducted from his non-marital interest, which is the $75,000 for the refinance in 2003, as well as the $11,300 from the Cooperstown payment, which benefited the party's minor child. And with that said, I have nothing further unless your honors have questions.
Appears to be none. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your answers to our questions today, your briefing in the matter, and we will now take the matter under advisement, issue a ruling within 90 days. You each have a good day.
Thank you.
And that concludes our oral calendar today.
All rise.